Good evening.
They do, and you know what? They're alienating the older people.
There are additional seats over there. Good evening. My name is Laura Godshall, and I'm a representative of the student board of the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. The Clark Forum Student Board serves to strengthen the bond between the Dickinson community and the Clark Forum in regard to speaker programming on campus. In addition to organizing extended conversations of the issues raised by Clark Forum guests, each semester our board creates and leads one Clark Forum program. Planning for this program began at the beginning of this year. On behalf of Dickinson College, the Clark Forum Student Board, and the Office of the Dean of Students, I would like to welcome you to tonight's program entitled, Should Pennsylvania Legalize Marijuana? Marijuana use in the United States dates back to our founding fathers, with George Washington cultivating cannabis as a fiber crop and Thomas Jefferson drafting the Declaration of Independence on paper made of cannabis fiber. However, serious recreational use of cannabis did not begin until the early 20th century. Federal drug policy began with the 1937 Marijuana Tax Act and the creation of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, with federal penalties increasing in severity throughout the mid-20th century, beginning with fines and escalating to imprisonment. Only in the 1970s did a few states begin to decriminalize marijuana possession and usage. In the 1990s, several states, including California, began to legalize medicinal marijuana in violation with the federal law. In Pennsylvania today, the penalties for possession and distribution of marijuana are incarceration and fines. Mr. Freed and Mr. St. Pierre are here tonight to discuss the effectiveness and implications of Pennsylvania's current criminalization of marijuana. David Freed has been Cumberland County's district attorney since 2005. A graduate of Washington and Lee University and the Pennsylvania State University's Dickinson School of Law, Mr. Freed is a member of the District Attorneys Association, where he serves as the chairman of the Communications Committee and as a member of the Education and Training Committee. In addition to his duties as district attorney, Mr. Freed lectures frequently to community and law enforcement groups and is a member of the faculty of the National Advocacy Center of the National College of District Attorneys. He also personally prosecutes homicide and violent felony cases. Alan St. Pierre graduated from the University of Massachusetts Amherst with a bachelor's degree in legal studies. He has worked with NORML, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, since 1991, first as the communications director and later as the deputy national director. Early in 1997, the NORML Foundation was created, and Mr. St. Pierre currently resides as its founding executive director. The NORML Foundation is a nonprofit, legal research, and educational organization whose main focus is to advance the agenda of marijuana law reform. He has appeared on hundreds of nationally televised news programs and has been cited in several national and local news publications. Tonight, we also welcome our moderator, Professor Daniel Kenny, a visiting instructor of the Department of Political Science at Dickinson College. At this time, I would like to remind you to please turn off all cell phones and pagers. Also, since this program is being taped and some of our audience members may be hearing impaired, please wait for a microphone to reach you before asking a question during the question and answer session at the end of this program. Immediately following the program this evening, there will be a continuing the conversation session in Stern Room 102 right through these doors. This will be an informal, student-led discussion about the program, and refreshments will be provided. The discussion is open to anyone who would like to attend. Now, please join me in welcoming David Freed, Alan St. Pierre, and Professor Daniel Kenny.
Thank you. We'll start with a five-minute introductory comments from Mr. St. Pierre, followed by 5 minutes with David Freed.
Thank you. Good evening, everybody. My name is Alan Francois St. Pierre, and much to my mother's chagrin, I'm the director of NORML. However, as you can imagine, and I think by the popularity of this discussion here tonight, despite 71 years of illegality, marijuana is a huge public policy topic in the United States. This is self-evident, even if you don't see it within the DNC and the RNC platforms. We're just going to quickly go through about 5 minutes discussion here. And for me, I just wanted to begin with a little levity. And that's simply that, and I'm going to harp on this tonight, if there's no victim, there's no crime. No victim, no crime. So, with that little cartoon, this is what we're really here to talk about tonight. We're here to talk about an arrest rate. I'm 43. So, oddly, at the beginning of my life, we see the arrest rate shoot from 2 per hour to 95 per hour. There were 830,000 marijuana arrests in 2006. 90% of them, traditionally, are for possession only. We're going to, in our five debate questions tonight, we're going to allude to this, and so I just wanted to put up a graphic in advance of it here. In 1994, I was at a National Institute of Drug Abuse meeting, and these researchers got up and gave a great lecture about the harm that drugs cause. And it made a lot of sense if you sat through the five-hour seminar, but some of us, including a New York Times reporter, said, well, could you put it in a chart so that most of us could understand it? So in 1994, this was on the cover of the New York Times. And I'll just quickly go over it for you. Marijuana, caffeine, alcohol, cocaine, heroin, nicotine, dependence, withdrawal, tolerance, reinforcement, intoxication. Graphically, you can see quite clearly that cannabis is, as compared to licit and illicit drugs, generally speaking, not that consequential. It's not harmless. No drug is. But as compared to something like even caffeine, why is it illegal, one could argue? On the 10th of October, the 20 millionth person in the United States will be busted for marijuana. 20 million people since 1965 arrested on marijuana charges. The heart of my discussion here, and we'll get into it tonight in juxtaposition, and I have never had this refuted in over 600 lectures and discussions. It's really quite simple. We don't live in a drug-free world. We never will. There never has been one. But regarding this juxtaposition between a bartender and a cannabis dealer, they perform the exact same function, do they not? And some of those juxtapositions are obvious. One's legal, one's not. Some of them should stand out to you as the true difference between one that is not perfect, because if I ask everybody here to raise the hand, raise your hand if you used alcohol before you were legally able to do so, I presume most hands would go up here. So we know the system isn't perfect. But this system, arguably, is so much more preferable to this system. Zoning versus no zoning, alcohol beverage control, taxations and license, single source distribution versus poly drug sales. One of my favorite things here, you know, a bouncer. What does a bouncer do? You know, bouncer separates bad drug users from the others. They look at IDs. And in my case, of being a bartender one time and seeing the bouncer go down the first shot, and it's just me, three wafy waitresses, $10,000 of cash in the till, and $20,000 of booze. And so when I watch that bouncer go down on the first shot from the right guard of the UMass football team,
you need to use the mic because I can't hear over here. If there's a lapel one,
would you rather? Oh, if there's a lapel, sure.
I'll
wear it. And so the where was I going with that?
The guard.
Yeah, thank you. And so what did I do? I called the police, and we welcomed the police to help us. If drug users, say, someone who's mad about a marijuana deal, or for that matter, a crack cocaine deal, and if it goes down bad and the police show up, they actually attack and go after the police. It's a completely different system. So while this is not perfect, and Dave's life is full of prosecuting people who abuse alcohol, and that's the other part of our discussion here tonight, the difference between use and abuse. Nobody at Normal, and in my 18 years of working there, advocates to abuse marijuana in the same way that we don't encourage the abuse of alcohol in our society. You can use it under limited circumstances as an adult. And those lines have changed in my lifetime drastically. I expect they'll continue to get narrower. But generally speaking, tonight's discussion, while it's about marijuana, generally is about cognitive liberty, personal responsibility. Thank you.
Yeah, we're going to have some technical time. Mr. Fried?
That's me. When we had a turnout like this at Washington and Lee, it meant that somebody was getting credit for attending. I want to thank the forum for inviting me. I want to thank Alan for agreeing to be here. We had a really great dinner beforehand and some wonderful discussion, and I think we'll have some great discussion tonight. By way of introduction, a dose of reality. That's Matt Norris. That's Matt Norris. He was a college student at Chippensburg. That's Sidney Bull. He was a college student at Chippensburg. Matt liked to sell a little weed, use a little weed. That's what was left of Sidney after Matt and his friends shot him in the face and set him on fire and dumped his body in the woods. Matt and Emmett Lockhart are doing life in prison along with their accomplice Dante Chambers. Reality of Pennsylvania marijuana possession sentencing. Possession of 30 grams or less, that's about an ounce, is an ungraded misdemeanor. Pennsylvania, we do sentencing on offense gravity score and prior record points. Offense gravity score is 1, you get an M for your prior record point. 7 plus M's gets you 3 prior record points, you can't get any more. That's the most you can ever get. With a prior record score 3, offense gravity score of 1, your recommended sentencing guidelines are RS to 6. That means probation to 6 months. Your maximum is 1 year. There are no low-level offenders sitting in state prisons in Pennsylvania for marijuana possession. We could certainly argue the wisdom of whether possession of small amounts should be criminalized or not, but let's be clear that low-level possession of marijuana does not have you languish in prison in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and certainly not in Cumberland County. Now, whoops. We do have mandatory sentences in Pennsylvania, and that's where the real jail time kicks in. There's a 2 to 4 year mandatory sentence attached to dealing marijuana, whatever the amount, in a school zone. This entire campus is a school zone. We've arrested people for selling marijuana on this campus. As long as I've been DA, we haven't sought the school zone mandatory, but it's out there. In fact, we rarely seek the school zone mandatory in Cumberland County. Other counties are different. School zones, I'll tell you, that's a hot button in the legislature, and I don't think school zones in their current form are going to be around too much longer. I think they're going to change. Mandatory sentences attached to possession with intent to deliver, not possession. If you can prove that your possession of marijuana is for your personal use, or better stated, if I can't prove as a prosecutor that it is for delivery, or if you have delivered or you intend to deliver, that's personal possession. There are no mandatories. Mandatories attach starting at 2 pounds. For those of you who don't know, everybody in the room probably does, you get marijuana sold, a normal amount in Cumberland County is a quarter ounce. 2 pounds starts mandatories. It's either by weight or number of plants, and they increase after that. 10 plants gives you a mandatory thereafter. Is it the crime of the century? Of course not. We have people getting raped and robbed, burglarized, murdered in this county. Possession of small amounts of minor offense, we treat it as such. We divert a ton of those cases. We used to do 2 drug tests during the diversion period in Cumberland County. We don't do that anymore because nobody ever passed. and we kept them forever. We had a bunch of potheads getting busted for possessing pot. So we eliminated the drug tests in diversion. I haven't had any complaints about that. By the same token, I haven't had any complaints from the citizens of Cumberland County, which is the county we live in, coming to me and saying, your enforcement of marijuana laws is ridiculous. You should decriminalize or legalize it. I think we have some great questions tonight. I look forward to the debate. I wanted to give you a little local flavor, and we'll turn it back over to the moderator. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fried. Just so everyone's clear on the format of the debate, we're going to do 3 minutes and then a 2-minute rebuttal, and we'll alternate each question. So we'll start with Mr. St. Pierre. Mr. St. Pierre, what is the rationale behind the current illegal status of marijuana, and is it valid?
How long?
We have 3 minutes.
Thank you. Well, this can be a dissertation-length reply, but it's pretty simple. I break it into two parts. One, marijuana was made illegal in 1937. If we were to put up the testimony given, we would all be laughing. Many of us here would be profoundly insulted. It was so racist, so non-scientific, so absurd. Most of us know it really as reefer madness. And the government began its sophistry regarding marijuana by calling the name of the act the Marijuana Taxation Act, because even back in the 1930s, the government didn't pretend it had the power to ban an individual plant. Alcohol prohibition came about because of an amendment to the Constitution, and then they had to re-amend the Constitution. That never happened with cannabis. Even more disturbingly, the government just never issued the tax stamps. So when you buy tobacco and alcohol in the United States, what's at the bottom of each one of those retail purchases? A tax stamp. That's how the government taxes and controls the substances. So that's what it was in 1937, and it's absurd. Rocket to 1970, and the federal government realized it was going to lose in an important case, saying, wait, I want those tax stamps. So then it came up with, it scrapped that entirely, realizing it was going to lose in the Warren Court, the liberal Warren Court, and it came up with the Controlled Substances Act, which you and I have grown up with, which takes drugs and puts them into five schedules. Schedule one, for the purpose of our discussion here, is marijuana, LSD, and heroin. Schedule 2 drugs, for which you can have legal access to through a doctor, all the other drugs you can possibly name and most of which we can't. Percocet, Mepidrine, morphine, codeine, Valium, OxyContin, all of that is legal, but the federal government, and has a rightful place in the pharmacopoeia, but the federal government argues that cannabis doesn't. And that's been the major dispute for all of these years. And the federal government has retained, through numerous challenges, the supremacy of this. But my frank answer, for those of us who lobby down in Washington, D.C., is that there are five pillars of pot prohibition in Washington. One is law enforcement. Law enforcement is the number one entity that opposes any changes at all levels. Two is the federal government. The federal government is the sui generis, the Partnership for Drug-Free America, for which I know you're all familiar with, the DARE program. All of it is driven by the federal government. Three, parents groups. Back in the 70s, parents groups really did oppose normal. Today, there are very few parents groups. They're mainly organs of the federal government. They get all of their funding from the feds. Fourth, which won't surprise you, are alcohol, tobacco, and pharmaceutical companies. And the one that should disturb you and you probably wouldn't think about are big defense contract companies. My example, simply, FLIR, Forward-Looking Infrared Radar. Very good if you want to find somebody in the field, or if you're in the military and want to hunt them down. Really good if you want to look at a house and find out the heat profile. But ultimately, FLIR...
Your time has expired. Thanks. Oh,
well, okay, may I finish the point?
Yeah.
Thank you. Just FLIR... The company that sells it wants to sell 10,000 of those units to mount onto helicopters to fly around to figure out if people like maybe you are growing marijuana in your house. So the head of that company might not care about marijuana prohibition per se, the morality of marijuana use, but they can't make money for selling those units to the federal government. So big multinational defense corporations are big, big players in the field of marijuana prohibition.
Thank you. And I'll just reiterate that we really need to keep within the time limits. Very important. Okay. 2-minute rebuttal.
Oh,
Mr. Freed. Yeah. 3 minutes.
I get 3 to answer the question, then he rebuts, and then I rebut him if I choose, right?
That's right.
Okay. Yes.
We're very rules-driven in the Cumberland County courts. The rationale, when you do what I do for a living, I don't decide what's criminal and what's not. I decide in my discretion what to prosecute and what not to prosecute. But what's criminal and what's not criminal is decided by the legislature, as you all know. So what do I do when I get a complaint and somebody comes in and says, is this a crime or is it not? I go to the books. So the rationale for marijuana being illegal in Pennsylvania comes from the Drug Device and Cosmetic Act. The factors are as follows: actual or relative potential for abuse, scientific evidence of pharmacological effect. I don't have the whole thing, but pharmacological, I'll say that now. State of current scientific knowledge, history and current pattern of abuse, scope, duration, and significance of abuse, risk to public health, psychic or physiological dependence liability, and whether the substance is controlled under federal law. All of this stems from the federal law initially controlling these substances, and then the states took over after that. So the legal rationale is indicated in the Drug, Device, and Cosmetic Act passed by the legislature. I could tell you the logical, or the, not maybe not logical, but the temporal rationale on the ground of the legislature in Harrisburg is that they want to be as tough on crime as they can possibly be, even to the point where they make the jobs of prosecutors very difficult in many circumstances by creating unrealistic mandatory sentences. I don't think the drug mandatories are necessarily unrealistic, but certain unrealistic mandatories that force us to actually have trials and endanger victims more because the offenders have to take a shot. Now, that's the playing field we're dealing with in Pennsylvania. Is it valid? Let me speak to that from my personal knowledge, or my personal experience, maybe that's a better word, as a prosecutor, which I've done for about the last decade. Come to see me on a Tuesday. Come visit some of the people that are forced to come to Cumberland County Court on a Tuesday and see what marijuana abuse has done to their lives. Or come see us on a Thursday for the people who are in treatment court engaging in their one last chance to get right. What I see on those times, it's a gateway, it begets addiction, poor decision-making, and violent outcomes.
Well, I can appreciate the personal viewpoint, but, and even the screen you put up there regarding these poor men, you know, who died and were shot by the others. Well, it wasn't marijuana, I presume, that caused them. I mean, most people are probably familiar with the term mellow and chill. Marijuana use does not cause people to be violent. Frankly, that was the very argument that Mr. Anslinger, our first quite insane drug czar from 1932 to 1964, claimed that marijuana made you violent. Prohibition is the problem here, ladies and gentlemen. I doubt that there are going to be very many cases Dave's going to try where somebody killed the other person over tobacco or killed them over alcohol or killed them over a pharmaceutical drug. Well, maybe that's not a good example, is it? OxyContin? Really problematic. And regarding visiting people on a Tuesday who have gone through the ringer that weekend and got arrested, well, yes, if you get arrested, you have to go through the criminal justice system, and people who engage in the abuse of alcohol are the ones that are there Tuesday morning, not the people that responsibly used alcohol. Again, that's the fulcrum I think that the discussion tonight is going to be on, is the responsible use of marijuana. And lastly, regarding treatment, well, in the United States, in my lifetime, we've developed drug courts, and you now have the Hobson's choice that even I would choose to go to treatment rather than go to jail. It's not really a very good statistic to point to regarding the potential harm of cannabis.
Mr. Fried?
Thank you. Responsible use is a myth. It's wonderful to talk about responsible use, but the reality on Tuesday is not people that got arrested over the weekend. It's people who, after abuse, and clearly abuse is the key. We're talking about abuse, but abusers started somewhere. And because I had a short introduction, I didn't really delve into this too far, but the point with the murder that took place was not, it was not that marijuana made these people violent. It's that the abuse of marijuana led to the poor choices that led to the violent act that took place. Now, drug courts, treatment, obviously that's reserved for the people who need it the most. What we're dealing with on a daily basis, in reality, are people who cannot use it responsibly. I haven't seen very many people who can use it responsibly because they don't come into the criminal justice system. So I guess a question we can delve into is, do we need to legalize it if the people who use it responsibly aren't finding their way into the criminal justice system? Perhaps that's a place where we'll disagree. Perhaps Alan will say there are people who use it responsibly in the criminal justice system. If they are, I don't believe that I see them.
Thank you. We're going to move on to the second question. And Mr. Fried, I'm going to direct this to you first. How does marijuana compare to other potentially body damaging substances, for instance, tobacco products, alcohol, pharmacological drugs, and is it more or less addictive?
This is a little bit of a more difficult question for me to answer because I don't have a level of expertise in this area. I did have some help from people at the Drug and Alcohol Commission who are here tonight, providing me with some information. Alan has a lot of information. That was an interesting slide that he put up comparing some of the drugs. From personal observation, again, what I've seen in my career as a prosecutor and as a high school and college student in the 80s and 90s, I think that marijuana, those who use it and use it regularly, I see it on par with prescription drugs, certainly less debilitating than heroin or cocaine. I don't think anybody could stand up here and credibly argue that marijuana use is on par with snorting heroin or sticking a needle in your arm or ingesting crack cocaine or freebasing, whatever form you want to use. Now, it does lead to the same type of poor decisions, and it disproportionately affects young people. In that sense, 25% of 12 to 17-year-olds who use display the characteristics of abuse or dependency. Now, I understand that what Alan's group talks about is responsible adult use. Okay, so I'm not saying that normal advocates children using, but you can't ignore the effect on young people. That number of compared to young people who use tobacco and use alcohol far exceeds the number who use marijuana and show signs of dependency far exceed those who use tobacco or alcohol. It starts younger than other drugs, and as I indicated a little earlier, the gateway nature of it is clear to us in the criminal justice system. It's clear to the people who work in the drug and alcohol treatment system. We see it all the time. We deal at the county level and the county courts. Everybody comes up for sentencing, and they want to explain why they did what they did. All right. People are generally honest when they do that. We don't put them under oath, but they're explaining to us what they did. And if it's not alcohol, they're starting with marijuana, and it's a gateway into the other drugs.
Thank you. Mr. St. Pierre?
Thank you. Well, in some ways, it's quite hard to compare marijuana to the three drugs or types of drugs that were discussed here. Tobacco. Tobacco kills 450,000 people in the United States only, per year. It's legal. It's taxed at the local, county, state, and federal level. Now, again, for those of us who have a certain amount of gray hair, we have watched the changes of tobacco laws in our lives. We've gone from, you could smoke tobacco in my eighth grade public school, standing outside, hey, everybody. You could smoke in an elevator. You could smoke on a plane. We are clearly watching, and when I give my college PowerPoint presentations, I have what I call the tobacco curve. In my lifetime, we've reduced tobacco use by half. It's arguably the most addictive substance that people interface with. We built no prisons. We took nobody's pee. We didn't racially discriminate. We didn't have mandatory minimum sentences. We didn't take away student loans. We achieved this very important, laudable public health goal by not using the expensive and blunt criminal justice system. Marijuana is not addictive. It doesn't even have an LD rating for toxicity. It has an LD 50 rating. You cannot die because of the use of cannabis. Regarding a gateway, it is the first illegal drug that people use, but sociologists and epidemiologists would be quick to point out that it is the first illegal drug. The first drugs that people use are alcohol and tobacco. And frankly, in the last 7 years, increasingly pharmaceuticals, pills, have been the drugs that children use. The Netherlands have had basically legal marijuana for almost 25 years, 30 years. And the basis of their entire policies is to shatter this particular myth, and that marijuana is not a gateway drug, it is actually a drug of terminus. The vast majority of Americans will freeze out their drug use at caffeine, tobacco, alcohol, and cannabis. Thankfully, very few people will ever go on an experiment and or get addicted to cocaine derivatives, methamphetamines, heroin. Thankfully, very few people. go from using marijuana to going and using these other drugs. It is in the distribution system. So in the Netherlands, by separating marijuana from the other illegal drugs, they've broken about the only bond marijuana has to those other illegal drugs.
Mr. Fried?
Thank you. That is just completely divorced from the reality of what we see in the criminal justice system. The sociologists and the epidemiologists can do their studies. They can talk about what they see based on people's voluntary response. We know in the system what we see on the ground. And we see the poor decisions it leads to. We see the effect it has on people's lives. Now, obviously, anything done in moderation is probably okay. We don't see a whole lot of moderation. We see a whole lot of abuse.
And I pick up on that very point in my rebuttal. It's the abuse. And I think all of us agree that there should be plenty of criminal and civil penalties against the abuse of a drug. And Dave has mentioned this term not only just a moment ago, but also from the way that the Pennsylvania statutes are written regarding what the effect of the drug is and does it encourage, say, poor decision-making. The criteria that Dave read out, kid me not, would alcohol not fit in that category in a lickety-split second? I mean, if I drank more than 14 ounces of anything bonded over 80 proof, I've got a good chance of dying right in front of you here. It's legal. It's taxed at four levels. So in my lifetime, I sure hope that down in Washington there'll be, we've got the BATF, Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearm. They don't moralize against those subject matters, even though all those things are dangerous, guns, tobacco, and drugs. All they do is tax it. And so in my lifetime, I sure hope that there's going to be a BATFNM down in Washington.
Thank you. And we're going to move to the third question. No? Mr. St. Pierre, would the legalization of marijuana make the drug safer in some way?
In many ways, it would. One of the most notable aspects of it, as we've sort of alluded to here tonight, is the criminality, the abuse factors, the fact that most of you have gone through the DARE program. That was your education about drugs as compared to real serious pharmacological discussions. And examples of this would be, how long should you wait to drive after you used marijuana? That kind of information would be good to know, would it not? But prohibition and the milieu of prohibition keeps that discussion from being really had in our society. Scientifically, we're seeing that in our lifetimes, we've gone from, you know, when I was a kid, there was marijuana cigarettes and joints, and then there was bongs, and then in the 90s, there were blunts. And where are we going now? Vaporization. So in about 20 years, there's not going to be a kid with a joint or a bong in his room. They're going to be vaporizing the drug. And what that means is that through legalization, you would basically reduce the harm associated with the drug. The most problematic aspect of using cannabis is smoking it and drawing it into your body. That's a given. So if you can reduce, one, the instances of smoking, and that's usually by having high-potent cannabis, and two, having something like a vaporizer. On the west coast of the United States, most medical marijuana patients do not smoke marijuana, they vaporize it. And I'll just quickly describe what vaporization is. You take cannabis, you heat the air to 240 degrees, you force the air through the cannabis, and in many cases, you capture it in a bag, and then it is inhaled. You get about, in layman's terms, 98% of what the cannabis consumer or the medical patient desires, and you don't get about 2%, or you remove, should I say, 98% of all the things none of us want to smoke, the fluorochlorohydrins and all, just terrible, terrible things that are in a smoke profile. So I think in the future, harm reduction will come largely through legalization.
Mr. Fried?
Legalization does not diminish the effects of using the drug. Legalization does not prevent people from showing the signs of abuse and dependency. I'm going to use another example. I know Alan loves when I do this. Robert Coles was high. And we're going to agree to disagree on this. You know, we're going to get mellow. Go listen to the Cleveland 73 bootleg and buy some burritos every time we smoke weed. Robert Coles was high from smoking blunts. He shot Johnny Badgett in the head about four blocks from here in 2002. They weren't fighting over drug dealing. They were high and got in a fight. Robert shot him in the head. The illegal nature of the dope had nothing to do with it. It was a state of mind, part of the state of mind induced. Now, Robert was an abuser. There's no doubt about that. What legalization will not do is diminish the effects of the drug. What legalization will not do is prevent the driving under the influence. It will not prevent the forgeries and the burglaries and all of the other behavior that's associated with using illegal drugs. And it won't diminish the role. Again, we'll agree to disagree on the gateway into the system. We've got a huge problem in this county growing with prescription drugs. I think that's an interesting part of this debate. It really is. We've got kids. Luckily, we haven't had anybody at Dickinson College. But we've got kids. I mean, 17, 18-year-old kids dying in this county at a really alarming rate. So we've got a huge problem with prescription drugs. It's interesting when we find out what was going on with these kids, whether they started with the prescription drugs, started with the marijuana, started with alcohol. Most do start with alcohol, as Alan indicates. In my experience, they're starting with the marijuana, not with the prescription. It leads them into it. But a lot of it is what you can get access to also.
Thank you. St. Pierre?
Well, I think it's, you know, some of us will probably look back when marijuana is legal and probably remember it being quite a bit more fun, if you will. We were talking at dinner earlier. I think when marijuana is legal in the next 10 to 20 years, you know, the idea of like, oh, we're going to get in the car and take a drive and go smoke a joint. No. Technology, our bitter, bitter, sweet friend technology is going to make it so that that's not going to happen. You're going to get in the car and you're going to get an eye scan. It's going to have an ion scanner that's going to determine whether you've been even close to cannabis. And these technologies are going to determine whether you're stoned or tired or hungover or impaired, which is the operative word here. So I think in the future, when marijuana is legal, technology, and a question I get asked often is, when marijuana is legal, will there still be drug tests? Yeah, there could still be drug tests. That's a social contract you have with your employer. Just because marijuana is legal, by the way, you can get drug tested in the Netherlands. Marijuana is legal there. So I think ultimately technology is going to take some of the fun out of marijuana, if you will, and highly compartmentalize its use. I mean, right now, it's used willy-nilly by anybody anytime they want. But for me, an old student of zoning, ultimately, land use law and zoning is one of the best ways to take a behavior, an adult behavior, which many of us might not like, we might be afraid of, we don't want, and to isolate it and to keep it legal, but to treat it differently, the way that we do with bars and casinos and adult bookstores, et cetera, et cetera. So I think in the future, America is going to look a lot more like Amsterdam than Moscow when it comes to the freedom people will have regarding cannabis use.
Mr. Fried?
Thank you. I think the technology argument, we did discuss this a little bit at dinner, I think it's an extremely clever argument. I think it's fanciful, though, for those of us who reside in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. We have to achieve a second conviction for driving under the influence of alcohol or drugs at a high rate before we can get a guardian interlock system attached to somebody's vehicle. As tough as our legislature wants to be on crime, they also, and rightly in my opinion, very much value our individual freedoms and privacy in the main in this Commonwealth. So I think it's a very clever argument. In 10 to 20 years, I don't know. I mean, when I was a kid, I used to watch the Jetsons and think we'd be flying around in spaceships when I got to be 38 years old. Well, we're clearly not doing that. So again, I think it's an excellent argument, but I think it's unavailing, at least at this point.
Well, if I may, with some rebuttal time left,
sure, there's time.
In Germany, where you can drive at unlimited speeds on the Autobahn, they have cannabis intoxication factor tests. So right now, in a society that is just as freedom-loving, just as industrial as ours, where they can drive at any speed they want, they do have tests that determine not whether you've used marijuana, that's not the point, whether you are abusing it or high while you have dominion and control over the car.
Thanks. I'm going to exercise a right to my right, executive decision, to ask a follow-up.
Sure.
And you have 1 minute to respond to this, which I don't think will take 1 minute.
Switching it up.
Right. Curveball. You've shown a lot of graphic pictures, told some graphic stories. Are these all instances of exclusive marijuana use, or was there also any other, for instance, were the gentlemen who were in the fight, were they drunk? Was the other people, this sort of ugly picture we saw initially, was that exclusively pot?
Excellent question. In the first
Thank
one,
you.
in the first one, the evidence at the trial indicated that it was exclusively marijuana use. They were together. The three who committed the crime were together, were smoking weed. They were having a dispute over money with Sidney Bull, and then they went and committed the act. Again, I don't say that smoking marijuana caused him to commit the act. I think it did impair the judgment. Robert Coles was drinking alcohol and smoking blunts that night. Best we could tell, because he tried to make an intoxication defense, but his blood alcohol level did not even reach the over the legal limit for driving. So he probably had maybe a 40-ouncer and a half based on the evidence in the case. Be interesting, Alan probably has this information, on the enhancement effects of either alcohol on marijuana or the other way around.
This is one of those situations where I get to, you know, really play the straight role here. Driving males, most notably, under the influence of alcohol, drive very aggressively. By the way, and while I'm not encouraging such, the science is pretty clear. Cannabis only, people drive genuinely fairly safer. They drive slower, more cautiously. That's not advocacy to driving. That's just what the science tells us today. But regarding Dave's point, and this is absolutely clear, if you use cannabis, never drive your car after consuming alcohol. The combination of the two can be deadly.
Thank you very much. So, Mr. Free, we're going to direct this to you. If possession of obscene materials in the privacy of one's own home can't be prosecuted, should the possession and use of marijuana in the home be similarly protected?
Sure. I encourage anyone who's interested in this question to read the Pennsylvania obscenity statute, and if you can understand it, give me a call at the DA's office and explain it to me. We actually recently convicted somebody under the obscenity statute, and it was somebody who had a real huge cache of child porn and other stuff that didn't really meet the definition of child porn that he was distributing. Now, I take a little bit of issue with the construction of the question. Obscenity is not legally protected. One can't be prosecuted for mere possession of it in one's home. That's different from specific codified protection. Picking nits a little bit, I think, but remember, all private activity in your home is protected by both the Pennsylvania and United States constitutions. Right? Now, you can't kill somebody in the privacy of your home and expect to get away with it. But the police cannot enter your home without your consent or a duly issued warrant supported by probable cause and signed off on by a judicial authority. Example, Penn State football. The DA up there is a good friend of mine, and he gets a lot of work from the football team lately, for good or bad. This week, the police went in a search warrant of an apartment with four of the players, one of whom is a local guy that went to Milton Hershey High School, and they found some marijuana, small amount, I think, of paraphernalia in there. They had a complaint from somebody who was in an apartment building at Penn State. Somebody made a complaint of smelling marijuana, and they went and investigated and were able to get enough information to get a search warrant and go in. Now, of course, nobody knew whose it was. Nobody's been charged yet. And I think they were shocked by marijuana in an apartment on a college campus. Having said that, I think we need to really understand that even the small amount prosecutions we're talking about are not police breaking people's doors down. They're not coming in with the high-powered rifles with the little red dot on them like I watched in Terminator the other day when I watched it again and had to kick my 7-year-old out of the room. Police aren't coming in to bust people for small amount in their homes without probable cause. And it rarely happens that way. It's usually out on the street, in the cars, or the four guys in front of me at the Springsteen concert a couple weeks ago smoking a joint, which I didn't dime them out, by the way.
Thank you.
I pretended I didn't know what it was. That was in Dauphin County.
Well, I think Dave's phrased it properly, that the way that the question was phrased was a bit askew, but the principle, obviously, is that in America, you have a zone of privacy. And the case that the Supreme Court ruled on a couple years ago, which is the dictate for this, really, is the Lawrence case out of Texas. And in layman's terms, that basically said that two gay people could engage in gay sex in their house and not fear the government kicking in the door and busting them. And while the conservatives on the court lost the case, Scalia's dissent, for me, is beautiful. Not because he agreed, it's because he basically set the compass for us. He basically said, listen, if we agree as a court, and the court did agree, he was in the minority, that you can have gay sex in your home, and that is within the realm of privacy. Even though we don't have privacy in our Constitution, it is an evolved theory for which we all believe we have, clearly. So in Scalia's dissent, he says, if we can do this, someday soon the marijuana advocates will be coming here saying they're going to be able to do the same thing in the privacy of their home. And that's exactly right. In the privacy of one's home, who's the victim? I mean, if you go home after working or being in school all day and you smoke a little cannabis and watch Jon Stewart, I know nobody does that, okay? And then you go and ravage a pint of Haagen-Dazs, there is no victim. A couple years ago, a friend of mine who's a prosecutor in South Boston, and Dave, I hope, can appreciate this, because I went to his, he had a trial, and the first case of the day was somebody who had beat up his girlfriend. And my friend, the prosecutor, he was great. He got up there, and he was behind her, put her hands on him, and he atoned to that jury that she had been wrong, she'd been harmed. You could hear the emotion in his voice. We went to lunch later, he came back, he had another case. It was a crack case where somebody had just driven by on a bike, bought a little thing of crack, and boom. And he tried that case, and it was rote, boring. He didn't use an adverb or an adjective. And afterwards, I said, boy, that was, do you realize how different you prosecuted those two cases? And he said, who was the victim in the second case? And even though, just like Dave, he upholds the law, he's sworn to uphold the law, he didn't see a victim in that case. And the reality, as I began this discussion, is if there's no victim, there's no crime. Now, of course, regarding alcohol, if you drive drunk and you get caught, there was no victim, but we know the potential is so high. So there are communitarianisms built into our law, to be sure.
Thank you very much. 2 minutes?
Thank you. To me, we don't need to read privacy into the Constitution. Privacy is inherent. It's an inherent human right. I know that's it surely takes up a lot of litigation with our friends in D.C., but it's an inherent right that responsible prosecutors take more seriously than anything else. We had a great discussion about this over dinner, and I want government out of my life as much as possible, too. And a lot of the decisions I have to make deal with how much government is going to intrude on someone's life. It's wonderful that we can have this debate about this issue. You know, victimless crime is an interesting buzzword, but if the percentages of the studies that I saw are even remotely correct, we have a lot of people using marijuana who will have a lot of deleterious effects on the way they live their lives. Now, that's not saying it'll happen to everybody. Again, there is not a ton of violence associated with the possession of small amounts of marijuana, luckily, in this county. And I think that's one of the reasons we can have this debate. Great point about the prosecutor trying the case differently. Very difficult to try drug cases sometimes. We have to come up with that. And I can tell you, your fellow citizens in Cumberland County often look at us and say, you know, what's the problem? Who's the victim here? One more final, very quick point to make. You should know, as residents of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, whether you're here as a student or whether you live here, you generally have more rights under the Pennsylvania Constitution than you do under the federal Constitution.
That's right.
And I wanted to make that point when I talked about the Fourth Amendment. I glossed over it. That's often to the chagrin of prosecutors, but I think it's an important point to make. Pennsylvania can be very tough on some things, but that's one thing where our legislature, as tough as they are on crime, really does respect the constitutional rights of our citizens.
Generally speaking, all the commonwealths do. I'm from the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, the Commonwealth of Kentucky. All of the commonwealths tend to have a little more respect for personal rights and provisions.
Thank you. We still, would you like to follow up? We still have time.
That's right.
We're good?
I'm confused about where we are, so you just keep running going.
Well, that was the end of the two-minute rebuttal.
Okay.
And we'll start, Mr. St. Pierre, sorry. Should marijuana be legalized for medical purposes? And what about the right of the terminally ill to use marijuana to relieve pain and suffering?
Well, it will surprise nobody that for 38 years, Normal has been litigating that marijuana should be available as a medicine. Now, what are the five diseases that people use marijuana for? None of which none of us would want to have. We wouldn't be like, I want the excuse of glaucoma so I can use marijuana. The five major disease types that people use marijuana for in the 12 states that have medical marijuana laws that have deviated from the federal government, which again speaks to the huge division in our country on this issue, the five disease types are glaucoma, where it reduces the intraocular pressure in the eye. 24 million Americans have glaucoma. About 90% of them respond perfectly well to the conventional pharmaceuticals. 10% of them don't, and many of them would immediately benefit from using cannabis, and we don't think they should be treated like criminals. The second are the AIDS and cancer patients. The AIDS patients use it for the cocktailing of AZT and other things. It makes them nauseous. When it comes to the cancer treatments, for which there's a growing amount of Americans who are under cancer chemotherapy treatments, it doesn't cure cancer. It doesn't cure AIDS. It helps with the treatments. So when you're throwing up from the nausea, I think most of you probably know that one of the serious side effects of marijuana is, one, increased appetite, and two, obviously with that, a suppression of upset stomach and vomiting. The third disease type people use it for is for MS. Fourth is epilepsy. And the fifth are for people who have quadriplegic and paraplegic. Now, in California, which is really completely deviant and aberrational to the other states, in California, you can get medical marijuana for virtually anything. A hangnail, my knee hurts, anything. But in the other states, which I think is the better example here, even though California is sort of a country unto itself and is so powerful legally and politically in our country and culturally, the other states, generally speaking, have self-preservation laws where if you have one of those five disease types, you can possess a small amount, you can grow a small amount, and that's really it. In a place like Oregon, there's about 25,000 people in the state registry. You can go up online and literally see who in each county, not the specific person, but you can find the disease type and their doctor that recommended it. So it's controlled. So when Dave's office, if he was in Oregon, someone got pulled over on the side of Route 5, you know, we're asking police a lot to figure out whether somebody's a medical marijuana patient or not. In Oregon, they just simply have to show their card, and as long as they're compliant with the law, the patient goes their way, law enforcement goes their way. Medical marijuana is in some ways a big side debate to the larger issue, but clearly it has gone to the Supreme Court twice in the last couple of years. We litigated it for 24 years, one of the longest cases in U.S. history. So clearly, self-evidently, based on my discussion here tonight, doctors should be able to prescribe marijuana.
Thank you. Ms. Fried?
Second part first. There's no right for terminally ill people to use marijuana to alleviate their pain and suffering. There's no right for them to use any particular medication. We've got to be careful about the term right in this context. Rights are provided to us by our constitutions. If there's a law that allows it, that's different. You may believe there's an inherent right, like I speak about privacy, but it's not there. Now, the first part. I'm the first to say I'm not a medical expert. Again, I see what I believe to be the effects of marijuana use, I think Alan would say abuse, on a daily basis. Stepped on my line a little bit earlier. You know, people aren't robbing and stealing because of their addiction to caffeine or nicotine. I'd really have to cut back on the Diet Coke if that were the case. My coffee substitute, I like to call it. Look, the medical professionals say this. Smoked marijuana is not medicine. State-sponsored medical marijuana ignores the FDA vetting process that every other drug goes through. Raw leaf smoking is not controlled delivery of medication, as with other medicines. There's high potential for abuse, which is really, I think, where a lot of us on the law enforcement side come down, is on the potential for abuse. That's really where we see the problem and, frankly, the reality of abuse. Existing legal drugs are superior for glaucoma, nausea, wasting syndrome, and cancer and MS. Marinol, which can be prescribed in Pennsylvania, the medicine form, is available for prescription. The American Medical Association says it should remain controlled. That's a distinction. They don't say legal or illegal. They say that it should remain controlled. That's their somewhat nuanced position, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting, you know, we talked a little, I mentioned when we were having a little discussion before dinner, anybody watch Entourage? Remember that episode where Drama and Turtle were trying to get marijuana prescriptions in California?
Yeah, that's right.
California's a different animal. For example, only 2% of the users at the San Diego dispensary are AIDS, cancer, or glaucoma patients. Most of the other ones are like Turtle and Drama, I think. So, interestingly, American Academy of Ophthalmology, no scientific evidence that demonstrates increased benefits compared with wide variety of pharmaceuticals available. AMA says it should be controlled and smoke-free. National MS Society, no convincing evidence. Institute of Medicine, I don't know what that is. You're probably familiar with it, Alan. Because of the health risks associated with smoking, smoked marijuana should generally not be recommended for long-term use. The point of all that is I think you can find information on both sides. Clearly, many medical professionals believe that there are properly dispensed medications that can have the same effect.
Thank you. 2 minutes?
Absolutely. As I acknowledge, most people do respond quite well to conventional pharmaceuticals, therapies, and surgeries. But for that respectable minority that doesn't, why would we treat them like criminals and put them through the criminal justice system, particularly if their licensed physician would have them use marijuana as compared to the other 400,000 drugs currently in pharmacopeia today? Couple of quick notes. I'm the script consultant to Entourage and to Weeds. And you know, we try to actually reflect what's going on. I mean, I'm critical of what's happening in California. I think they're playing way too loose with the law out there, and they could threaten the progress made in the United States regarding the total reforms of marijuana laws. We talked earlier about a right that is not in the Constitution, privacy. I think self-preservation is a right. Is it not the right of your own life, particularly in consultation with your doctor? If your doctor would say, I would not have you use these drugs, but I would have you use this. It's so ironic is my conservative friends don't want the government to get into that, between that relationship between the doctor and the patient, but have no problem doing so if it has to do with marijuana. The example Dave brought up of San Diego I am familiar with, but it is a classic cherry pick from the DEA for which is not a trustworthy entity in this discussion. Acknowledging there are abuses in California, having been to some of those clubs and actually seen the hundreds and hundreds of people that go through there a day, I'd say about 20% of them are probably abusing the law. The other 80% of them are in compliance with the law. So I hope in time the law will reflect what most of our experiences are when you go and get a drug. You get a pharmaceutical. You see a doctor. They give you a prescription. You then get it. It could be everything from marijuana to OxyContin. But in our society, you have to use it responsibly. If you don't use it responsibly, civil and criminal justice, no problem.
Thank you. 2 minutes, Mr. Freed?
It was interesting to me in doing some of the research to prepare for tonight to remind myself that the Attorney General of California is Jerry Brown.
That's right.
And the older ones of us in the room, I think, get a big laugh out of that. But many of you might not know who that guy is, but they called him Governor Moonbeam back in the day, and he dated Linda Ronstadt, if any of you know who that is.
Yeah, you're really dating yourself, Dave.
But there was an interesting article about, finally, the Attorney General coming out with some guidelines what's right and what's not under medical marijuana. Medical marijuana is an interesting debate. We haven't really had it in Pennsylvania. It's really never caught fire. I think it's very interesting. I learned a lot in doing the research for this presentation. You know, the bulk of the legal medical marijuana is on the West Coast, and where would you expect it in the Northeast? Vermont, New Hampshire.
And Maine.
And Maine.
Yeah.
Sort of, you know, I don't think it's a liberal conservative thing. As I said earlier tonight at dinner, I think it's more of a libertarian versus non. And I think it's an interesting issue. As I said, it concerns us. The potential for abuse is what concerns us in law enforcement. And just in closing, there's not enough time or resources for us to go around kicking down doors and stopping people from smoking a joint and watching Jon Stewart or Colbert Report. It's just not happening. So I think it's a great issue to have a debate on, but let's debate what's really going on when we talk about enforcement and not these fanciful ideas of people getting their doors kicked in and getting busted for small amounts of marijuana.
Thanks very much. And one more time, I'm going to exercise the executive privilege here. You use the term abuse a lot, and I think you're talking about two separate things, right? Because at the one, Mr. St. Pierre said that marijuana is not addictive, right, if I understand it correctly. Mm-hmm. And you're saying that there's abuse. So if it's not addictive, where does the abuse come from?
It's certainly my position that it is an intoxicating substance that can be abused and is abused. I think actually we're talking about the same thing when we talk about abuse. I don't say that use of marijuana in and of itself is abuse. It's illegal in Pennsylvania. Well, no, the smoking of it is not illegal. The possession of the marijuana and the paraphernalia to smoke it with is illegal. The actual smoking is not illegal. Mm-hmm. But the abuse is the overuse of an intoxicating agent.
Well, one of the things that I'm sure Dave learned early in his law school, maybe career first day, is the difference between malum in se and mal prohibitum laws. And for those of you who are going to go on to college, go on to law school, or appreciate Latin early in life, malum in se laws are essentially laws that are derived, it doesn't matter whether you live on an atoll or in the most sophisticated society in the world. You don't lie, you don't cheat, you don't steal, you don't harm other people's properties. And most all countries' laws are organized around that. Mal prohibitum laws are really just laws within the epoch that we're living in. For example, the law said that women were not intelligent enough to vote. Was the law right? The law was insanely wrong. The law said that people who had different skin pigmentation than I had couldn't vote or couldn't be part of the society in a full way. Was the law right? The law was wrong. And I think what we're living through right now is an epoch where marijuana is illegal. I think later on we will look back at it and realize that it was a mistake to make it illegal.
Thank you very much. We're now going to move to an audience Q&A, and I believe we have mics.
This is for Mr. St. Pierre.
Yeah.
I was just curious what, and this may be a large question, you can simplify it, but what sort of would be the ideal marijuana use laws that you or Normal mm-hmm. kind of advocate for?
Good question. In fact, even Normal's board of directors, we ourselves are not resolved on what would be the very best laws. So from my own personal point of view, I would tell you idealistically, and I do mean this is idealistic, we would simply legally control it like alcohol products. In some states, the state is the seller of the alcohol. I think in 19 of the 50 states, you've got the Alcohol Beverage Commission that actually sells you the booze. But I favor a licensing, which most of us are familiar with, where the licensee has to go out and go through all these different liabilities and sell the drug like that. But having worked almost 20 years in Washington, D.C., and in many of the state houses, politically we're not there yet. So what I favor right here and now is what I call radical decriminalization. You get caught with, say, a couple of ounces or below, no penalty. And you can grow, 5, 10, 20 plants, some nominal amount, and that if you're an adult and it's on your property and you're using it, you should not face a serious criminal fine or penalty. So that's the sort of two-tier answer, that we should legalize it and put it in a controlled stream of revenue like we do to alcohol, tobacco, and pharmaceutical. But realistically, outside of Humboldt County in San Francisco City, there's not a lot of the country that embraces that.
Hello, my name is John Steindl. I come from Shippensburg. I used to carpool with Dante Chambers before the incident happened at hand, and before he had started smoking marijuana. He was a very violent, very disturbed young man who he advocated the gangster life, as people here know what that advocates. Wouldn't you agree that by making marijuana illegal, you are creating drug dealers to create such an atmosphere where such things could happen? If it was illegal, wouldn't you be putting, if it was legal, wouldn't you be putting the power back into the judicial system to moderate, to regulate, and to even tax and bring money into the revenue?
Well, I think that's an excellent question, and that's certainly an argument for making it a different schedule controlled substance as opposed to a legal substance. The fact that marijuana is illegal does not, in my estimation, promote the gangster lifestyle. And Dante, if you remember the facts as well, was really just sort of an accomplice in that escapade. I think you're barking up the wrong tree if you blame the fact that we've made marijuana illegal for the gangster lifestyle. The gangster lifestyle, to me, that we don't luckily have much of in Cumberland County, is people who want to make money by illegal means, take things that don't belong to them, and do so by violent means. We could sit here all day and debate, whether that's nature or nurture on the sociological aspects of it. And certainly we, as prosecutors and police, are reactive rather than proactive. I'm not trying to dodge the question. It's a better question for the legislature than it is for a prosecutor. But certainly we try not to do anything to promote further violence.
What you are touching upon in the 1930s was called the Al Capone effect, and the idea that within that context were the seven golden rules of prohibition. One of them was the creation of Al Capone people who were violent, people who didn't wear suits and ties and were members of the Chamber of Commerce and all that stuff. And second is that it created a profound disrespect for police. That's not good in a democracy, ever. And regarding gangsterism and marijuana, oddly seems to be linked in some interesting ways. As many would imagine, I look probably more like a narc than the head of Normal, and that it was a little odd for me to meet with the band Cypress Hill when they wanted to become Normal's official rap band. And I went and met with them in Los Angeles, and as they were rolling blunts bigger than my arm, he said to me, you guys don't really strike me as legalizers. You seem to like almost revel in the illegality of it. And one of the guys, this guy named Zendog, says, yeah, if you guys ever make it legal, we'll never sing about it again. And I think there is something to the allure of it. Now, frankly speaking, even though Budweiser and whiskey is legal, you can still turn on a country music station and hear plenty of songs about the good and bad of those drugs.
So they ended up choosing the Black Crowes as the house band. interesting parallel to prescription drugs here, I think, because prescription drugs are controlled only to be accessed by prescription, by qualified physicians. There's an incredible black market going on in prescription drugs. You may read, if you consume the news around here, the Carlisle paper or the Harrisburg paper, you may read about pharmacy burglaries or pharmacy robberies or drugstore burglaries or robberies. Those are all going after prescription drugs. That's all that's going on. I fear that if we regulate marijuana in the same way, we're going to end up in the same boat.
I'm just curious. When it comes to states that have decriminalized marijuana, do you see that, after that, there are increases in marijuana smoking?
Your question's a good one. It's the matter of fact, when marijuana was advocated in the 1972, the largest government body report ever on this, the Governor Schaefer, the former Republican governor of this very Commonwealth. In fact, what's so great about this is you can literally go to the Internet. You are so blessed you live in the Internet age, right, that you can actually go and listen to Governor Schaefer come into Mr. Nixon's office in 1972 and tell him, the Schaefer Commission is going to recommend that we decriminalize marijuana, and you can hear the expletives from Mr. Nixon, which then in the next tape he blamed Jewish psychiatrists for wanting to legalize marijuana. I mean, again, I just throw in a bit of history because it's so oddly Interesting. But one of the first things that commission said is the states that would decriminalize marijuana, and nine states did in the 1970s, that the National Academy of Sciences and the Institute of Medicine had to publish a report, and they did in 1982, that said, what are the effects of decriminalizing marijuana? And kind of all the obvious questions you and I would agree to. Do people use it more? Was there greater absenteeism in school? Were there greater accident rates? No. Every pathology you would point to was the same. You know, they juxtaposed Ohio, which allows for 100 grams. That's 3 ounces of marijuana, to Indiana, where marijuana is very strict, and it had the same use rates, everything. So generally speaking, all decriminalization does is it makes it so that when a person gets caught with marijuana, it's about a 10-minute interface. You run their Social Security number into the NNIC computer to make sure you're not dealing with a fleeing felon or somebody who's skipping out on paying child custody, which 99% of people aren't, which is good. Police ascertain that right on the side of the road today. They then take the cannabis from them. That's supposed to be the number one goal, is get the contraband off the street. Number three, they then basically get what I call a left-handed tax, a $100 to $200 fine. One party goes their way, and we presume the police destroy the contraband, and the individual goes their way, and they only have to pay a couple $100 fine. So in those states that have decriminalized marijuana, and I would note here, one out of three of us, 100 million Americans live in a state or a municipality where marijuana is decriminalized. And so I frankly, you know, point to Ohio and Indiana. Ohio, it's legal for up to 100 grams, and in Indiana, it's not. And Ohio has not gone to hell in a handbasket.
Thank you.
So you say. been to Ohio lately, Al? No. I'm joking. Ohio's a wonderful state. I can't find the document that I had earlier today, but there's some interesting statistics. I think it's from a 2006 report about number of reported first-time users, comparing that to states that have medical marijuana. And I think it was sort of evenly split, 5 of the top 10 states. Yeah. So, you know, you could say yes and no. In 5 of those states, they were 5 of the top 10 states for initial use by self-report in this study.
But generally, there's going back to an example in the Netherlands, there where they've basically legalized marijuana for almost 25 to 30 years, the rate of children using marijuana is much lower than even here, where kids are exposed to DARE and the Partnership for Drug-Free America. And the age of their first use of marijuana in the Netherlands is 15 and a half years old. You want to guess what it is in this country? 13.2 years is the average first, meaning in the first couple of months of your eighth grade experience is when statistically most people use marijuana in this country for the first time. And lastly, regarding the Netherlands, is that the rate of children going on to use harder drugs is almost 70% less than ours. So there's not a causational effect here at all. We go through wild cycles in Occidental countries regarding drug use, and much of it cannot be explained by psychiatry, economics, sociology.
So you talked about how there was a lot of support for anti-drug laws.
Yes.
But what's the support like for people that are for it? Who's supporting that in Washington?
Who's supporting reforming laws? Sure. Well, in Washington, D.C., if you ask the question legalization, you will get very few, frankly, when it comes to the 500-some-odd members of Congress. Here's some numbers that will help put this in some context in the United States, away from your question regarding politicians. 75% of Americans in polls over 30 years, not just taken by Normal, but Gallup, Reuters, et cetera, 75% of Americans, if you ask the question, if you get caught with a small amount, should you only face a small fine rather than go to jail? So 3/4 of Americans, it's a given decriminalization. About 70 to 75%, same percentage, think that medical marijuana ought to be available if a physician thinks it should be. But this is where my hair has gotten prematurely gray and the real hard work is left. Only about 38 to 40% of Americans, if you ask, should marijuana be legally taxed and controlled, like alcohol, tobacco, pharmaceuticals, and we threw in gambling, and only 40%. So there's a 35% gap in American attitudes between decrim and medical. Let's assume that as a society we're okay with that. But we're not okay yet with legalizing marijuana. And so therefore, our politicians logically don't reflect that. Now, geographically, they do. I mean, when I go to San Francisco and I'm wearing my little normal lapel pin, you know, I'm treated like a conquering hero. In Washington, D.C., people ask me if I'm Canadian.
Thank you. Hi. This two related questions for Mr. Fried. Can you hear me? Is this free?
Yeah.
Right, the first one has to do with a statistic you sort of alluded to earlier, that there was a high incidence or high correlation between violent behavior and illegal drugs. And of course, that's not the issue, right? It's not illegal drugs. It's a high correlation of violent behavior and marijuana use specifically. So my first short question is, can you give us some information of comparing only marijuana use with high incidences or incidence of violent behavior and alcohol? And so that question to my larger one. It sounds like the rationale that's been given for the continued illegality of marijuana possession, not smoking, is that there's a high incidence of abuse and impaired judgment. And of course, these are the exact same criteria of alcohol. Right. In fact, there might even be alcohol is physically addictive in addition to being psychologically addictive. There's all kinds of dangers of alcohol that may exceed, or you know, according to some studies, marijuana use. So I guess, and this has certainly been mentioned earlier, but I guess what I want to hear is an sort of explicit response. Why should marijuana be illegal when alcohol is legal, if these two criteria are very similar? Thank you.
Certainly. Well, the first part of the question is, we don't spend a lot of time trying to get behind what substance is abused when there's violent behavior. I can tell you 85% of the cases we do stem in some form or fashion from drugs or alcohol being the influence of drugs or alcohol, or they're doing it to get money to buy drugs and alcohol. Two of the examples I used are cases that I know that marijuana use was involved. So I don't have that specific information. I'm telling you anecdotally. Now, the comparison between alcohol and marijuana, you know, that's a tough question for me to answer because I'm not a scientist. I don't have the science. I see, in a global sense, people impaired from prescription drugs, cocaine, heroin, alcohol, committing all sorts of crimes, violent and not. So it may come down to abuse again. Is the sort of recreational marijuana smoker out there committing a larger amount of crimes percentage-wise than the recreational cocaine or some other drug user? No. Generally, the violent crimes you see are from people who are in the throes of more of an addiction than marijuana. My fear from what I hear and see is for people who are maybe physiologically made up to go that way, the use that turns into abuse of marijuana does lead to the abuse of these other substances. I'm not trying to dodge. I think that's the best I can do, though. I swear an oath to uphold the law. I have a lot of discretion on how to do it. I mentioned the drug testing we did as part of our diversion program that we don't do anymore. Having said all that, you know, we do have a hierarchy of some crimes are more serious than others, without a doubt. But by saying that, I don't want to minimize the effect that I think abuse of not only marijuana but alcohol, prescription drugs, and other drugs can have on someone's life.
A couple of things. One regarding, I appreciate that Dave is letting you know that he has subjectivity when it comes to what cases. And police have to arrest. Let's be clear here. We do not want police playing judge, jury, and prosecutor on the side of the road at 4 in the morning or whatever. They must arrest under almost all circumstances. The filter in our society is people like Dave, who then he's going to have to take his mores and values to the extent that they reflect where he lives and then decide, what am I going to do with this? And take the heat for making that decision. So he makes the point here, I say blessedly, that if you get caught with a small amount of marijuana in Cumberland County, it's fairly inconsequential, and you're not going to jail for it. Well, I work at the national level. That doesn't happen in Enid, Oklahoma, okay? I assure you it does not happen in Fort Wayne, Indiana, or Savannah, Georgia, or Elgin, Texas, all lovely places we've had to litigate the teeniest little cases. We represented a guy named Jim Montgomery in Enid, Oklahoma. He was a quadriplegic. He could only move his head. He was in a wheelchair, got caught with 2 ounces of marijuana and got 2 lifetime sentences. So where we live in this country is crucial about how the disposition of justice is going to happen. A point regarding marijuana, and to your question regarding marijuana and violence, and so here's my lovely anecdote. I was at the Seattle Hemp Festival 2 weeks ago, and there were 300,000 pro-marijuana supporters there. And it's my job as a director every year, I have to meet with the head of security, the chief of police, and by the way, the former chief of police of Seattle, Norman Stamper, is on our board of directors now, sort of speaking to the change where this is all going. But last week, or 2 weeks ago when I was talking to him, I said, well, here we have 300,000 people. They made no arrests for marijuana at the event. And he said to me, as he tapped me on the back as we said goodbye, because I'll see him again next year because we've been doing it for 17 years there, he said, I am so glad that none of these people are exposed, that they don't use alcohol. He's like, this is, you can't even compare these 2 days of 300,000 people in the park to one baseball or football game at Safeco Field in Seattle. And they go through 80 of those a year. So he said, this is like a walk in the park for my officers and I. And I have that being told to me from the heads of police in New York and Philadelphia and Boston, where we hold other huge rallies. They're very happy that many tens of thousands of people are not interfacing with alcohol, but interfacing with marijuana.
And I think a point to add to that is, you know, if you follow this, and I think Alan makes this point better than anybody, the attack on these laws is at the state level, which to me is where it should be. You know, in Philly, they would laugh at some of the cases that we try to a jury trial in this county because they have 350 murders a year. But you need to, when you're thinking about these questions, which are great questions to think about, you need to think about where you are and the fact that you can't get 2 life terms for possessing a little bit of marijuana in Pennsylvania. It just can't happen.
Yeah.
Now, we lawyers are funny. I wish we will go in there and we'll litigate a small amount of marijuana case on a big suppression issue because there's not that big of a downside. I mean, those are great to take up to the Supreme Court. And the judges love them and the appellate judges love them because, look, if the guy's convicted, it's not that bad. If he's acquitted, that's not that bad either. You know, I wish Ernesto Miranda had only been possessing a small amount of marijuana. You know, the Miranda warnings, Ernesto Miranda was a really bad dude. And I hate having the right named after a bad guy. I'd rather have it named after a pothead, but that's not the way it is.
Fortunately, we are running short of time, so this will be the last question.
Oh, he's got it.
This question is more or less for Mr. Fried. It seems that through your arguments that you liken marijuana to violence, and it seems that the illegality of a substance or a drug has some correlation to the harmful potential it has. Were the instances, the violent instances you said, a direct result of marijuana intoxication, or was it caused by some form of external stimulus that it just so happened that that person was high at the time?
Well, I think that's a great question, and that's something that we never know in my business. What I know is the evidence of what happened and what I can prove, and I know in those two murders there was marijuana being ingested. I know that it happens. We've got fights. We've got robberies that happen. Can I tell you scientifically that the smoking of marijuana caused violent behavior? No, and I wouldn't try to make that argument to you because I don't think I can, credibly. But I can say that I know marijuana use and abuse was involved in these situations, what I see on the ground, which is what I hope that I've been able to express is just a little local flavor on what we see going on here. Excellent question.
On behalf of Dickinson College and the Clark Forum, I would like to thank our panelists and moderator and present them with a token of our appreciation. At this time, I would also like to remind you of our informal student-led continuing the conversation discussion, which will take place in Stern Room 102 directly after this, located through there. This concludes tonight's program. Thank you for coming, and have a great evening.